Our first speaker is one of my colleagues, Dr. Dave Riley. He's a Rothermel Baskin Professor of Human Ecology at the University of Wisconsin here in Madison, and he's a Child Development Specialist in University Extension. He's the author of many articles for the public as well as for scientific audiences. In fact, his name may sound kind of familiar to you, especially if you've had a baby recently in Wisconsin. You may have read his famous newsletters called Parenting the First Year, and the sequels, Parenting the Second Year and Parenting the Third Year. These newsletters are received by over 40,000 Wisconsin families each year, and by many other parents in 15 other states that are distributing the newsletters. Also, his work with county extension offices in Wisconsin has led to 92 new child care programs being established in the state. Now, he has a very long list of awards. Let me mention just three. In 1996, he received one of the premier awards in the country. He was recognized by the American Psychological Association for distinguished contributions to psychology in the public interest. Last year, he was one of just two people in the country recognized by his peers for being the best extension specialist in the country. And in 1993, he was recognized for child abuse prevention by the Wisconsin Committee for the Prevention of Child Abuse and Neglect. And Dave tells me that he and his wife are learning child development from their daughter, Hannah, who's a very delightful young lady. She's 10 now, Dave, right? Now, having worked with Dave for over a decade, I can tell you he's a wonderful colleague to work with, and I'm really glad he's decided to stick with academia and extension. Because over the years, he's worked as a Head Start preschool teacher. He's been a fireman. He's supported himself as a potter. On the side, he served on a city council out west. He does a little fly fishing. And he's been collecting a new longitudinal data set on the signs of spring in Madison. So if you want to know when the first robin was sighted in Madison or when the first tulip bloomed, and kind of any time during the last decade, you just need to give Dave a call. In the department, we call him Ranger Dave. So his topic today, though, is not signs of spring, but do we know what good parenting is, and can public policy promote it? So thanks a lot, Dave, for doing this today.
I asked Karen to keep the introduction brief. What is good parenting? Well, you know, anyone who's raised more than one child can tell you that what worked with the first one often doesn't work with the second. And if you've traveled, then you know that good parenting can be dramatically different in different parts of the world. And parenting, on top of that, is so intensely personal that married spouses who seem compatible in just about every other way often have fundamental disagreements over how to raise their own children. And I see a few heads nodding in agreement with that one, at least. We should be surprised, therefore, if researchers can agree on what competent parenting is. But, you know, to a surprising extent, researchers can give a pretty coherent picture of competent parenting across the years of childhood, at least. The picture is going to have some variations depending upon the age of the child and the gender of the child, and also variations depending upon the culture of the family, since families have to decide what kind of children they want to raise. This picture is going to be very complex. I'm going to ignore most of that complexity this morning, thankfully. And researchers are quick to admit that our knowledge is incomplete as well. But having said that, I think it's fair to say that to a surprisingly great extent, we can observe normal interactions of parents with their children at home. And from those observations, we can predict quite a bit about children's later compliance or non-compliance with their parents, about their cooperativeness or their aggressiveness with their peers, about their school success or their school failure, and many other outcomes of interest to most families. The strongest consensus surrounds parenting in the infancy period, when the characteristics of competent parenting are most strongly affected by biology and least strongly by culture. The best single indicator of a competent parenting in infancy is a securely attached baby. Now, like other mammals, we humans have instincts that guide us to develop parent-child attachments in infancy. These attachments are related to the imprinting and bonding that you hear about in other species. But our attachments don't crystallize suddenly at birth as in some species. They have an instinctual base, but they also develop with time and experience, and they can change. You are observing attachment processes all the time. For example, when you see a startled child run over and hug her father's knee, when you see a crying infant cuddle into his mother's arms and settle down, when you see a crawling baby stop, look back over his shoulder, make sure mom and dad are really watching before continuing across the floor, or even when you see mom or dad jump up to calm a crying baby. That also is part of our attachment processes. Strength of attachment is one thing. Type of attachment is another. And you can have insecure but strong attachments at the same time. Natural observations of family life in many countries confirm that there are a small number of commonly recurring types of attachment. In America, about something like 65 or 70% of babies form a secure attachment with at least one of their parents, while the remaining about 30% are dispersed among three main types of insecure attachment. Now, a securely attached one-year-old and his caretakers are mutually skilled at calming the child's fears and meeting his needs. These securely attached babies may appear indulged and spoiled if you really look at the kind of parenting they're getting, but they end up not being spoiled at all. They end up becoming the least clingy and the most independent 2- and 3-year-olds. By this age, they are also far more likely to be compliant with their parents' requests. They learn to adapt themselves to their caretakers' plans at the same time that they learn how to influence their parents with their own plans. The first figure shows the general pattern as we understand it. When parents balance their child's goals with their own goals, and their children learn the same social strategy, then you find parent-child relations that have a lot less conflict. On the curved U-shaped line, if you're way over on the left, it suggests a parent-style interaction where the parents' goals prevail, and way over on the right, just exactly the opposite. Where goals are balanced and there's reciprocity and mutual sensitivity, we find considerably less conflict between parent and child. For example, a mother may tell her toddler to wait for her to read him a story until she finishes a telephone call. And he's able to inhibit his demands, at least for a couple of minutes, because he has learned to trust his mother. By the age of 4, these securely attached children are observed to be far more cooperative with peers than insecurely attached children. And by age 8, they're getting into fewer fights at school and other problems at school. So what leads to a secure attachment? I'm going to be very brief here. Observations in thousands of homes on several continents consistently show us that parents who are available to their babies, who are sensitive in their interactions, and who are responsive to the baby's cues are the ones who are much more likely to develop these secure attachments. Other research verifies that we, in fact, can teach parents to be more like this, and that's pretty important. For example, some of the rigorous evaluations of intensive home visiting programs have shown significant increases in secure attachment in the families that receive them. So to summarize, if there's any single indicator of successful parenting during the infancy period, it's the securely attached baby, because it predicts so many positive outcomes in the years to come. And we believe that early attachment has such a large and pervasive impact on people's lives because the earliest relationships become the model for later close relationships. Let me give you a concrete picture of what that might mean from the history of a hypothetical insecurely attached child. During their first year of life, some babies learn that other people do not consistently respond to their needs. Sometimes mom and dad answer their cries, sometimes not. Sometimes they're sensitive, sometimes not. Mom and dad aren't reliable. Now, I should note that none of us are perfectly consistent and reliable with our babies, but most of us are good enough at it, while a sizable minority of parents are not. They are fundamentally failing to meet their baby's emotional needs. These babies come to view close relationships as sort of like a power struggle between people who have different and competing needs. These children are slow to develop empathy for others, and they fight with peers and parents much more in the years to come. As adolescents and young adults, their intimate relationships, when they begin to form them, are much more likely to be based on getting what you can out of the other person rather than on a foundation of mutual caring and reciprocity. I wish I could tell you that this was only a hypothesis, but in fact we have research confirming this general picture of lifespan development. These ways of thinking that the child develops about social relationships are first formed before babies even have language, so you can imagine how fundamental these mental structures are and how difficult to change. I'm going to shift now from infancy to childhood. I'm going to tell you about just one series of studies out of many thousands, but it's one that provides, I think, the most useful summary about what we know. This is research on a style of parenting we call authoritative parenting. I'll start with a specific study, and I'm going to tell you how the research was done so you can make up your own mind whether to believe it. You shouldn't just take my word for it, in my view. I'm going to start with a woman named Diana Baumrind and her colleagues at the University of California, who began their studies in the 1960s by carefully observing 110 preschool children, ages 3 and 4, in their preschools. Now, after 3 months of observing them, they rated each child on a long list of traits. So they had cards that had names on them, words on them like generally happy or sets difficult tasks for self. Baumrind could have asked, what predicts each of these traits? But she noticed that children's behavior is organized in consistent repeating patterns or combinations of traits. And she was able to mathematically identify three consistent clusters. Here they are as she named them. The first she called competent children. These are children who were generally happy. They were self-reliant. when there was a new situation, they were active and assertive in approaching it. The second group she called withdrawn. Generally less happy. They had fewer friendships. They were low on approach to new situations. The third group she called immature. Low on self-reliance, low on approach to new situations. Now, don't be surprised if you aren't sure which category your own child fits into. Only about half the kids fit into these pure patterns. The rest were in between or in a fourth group that we hadn't identified at that time. Baumrind decided to take the children who fit into these three pure types and follow them home. Actually, it was poorly paid graduate students who followed them home with clipboards and observe them in their homes to see what kind of child rearing they were receiving. She was interested in four specific aspects of behavior. The first was control. That is the parent willing to exert influence, able to resist pressure from the child, consistent in enforcing directives? Maturity demands, number two, is the parent willing to pressure the child to perform up to their ability? Does the parent insist on independence, on chores, on manners, things of that sort? And also give the child leeway to make their own decisions. Rational discussion is three. You got high scores on this if you used reasoning to obtain compliance, if you asked the child's opinion, if you listened to the child's reasoning. Low scores if you give in to a lot of whining and emotional pressure from the child. And fourth, nurturance. You got high scores here if the parent expressed love and caring for the child. Now, this fourth one was not a measure of how much you loved the child. It was how much the poorly paid graduate students could observe you expressing that love visually. The researchers made two visits to each home. Now, let me ask you, if you had a poorly paid graduate student with a clipboard in your kitchen watching you at night, how many of you would act exactly the same as any other day? Yeah, most of us try to show our best face to visitors in our homes, whether they have a clipboard or not. But Baumrind was clever enough to include at least one observation between the very difficult hours of 5 and 8 in the evening. So ask yourself, could you really change your family's routine during these hours enough to present a greatly altered view of parent-child relations in your household? Or another way to think about it is, think about times you've had guests over for dinner, and was it really easier to get your kid to go to bed at night? Exactly. The researchers recorded every instance of one family member trying to influence another. And I'm going to read you two excerpts from her actual data, all right? Very brief. Here's family one. The family is at the dinner table. The boy gets up. Father, hey, sit down, he yells it, but good-naturedly. The boy sits down, finishes his meal. Boy gets up. What do you say, Todd? Boy, excuse me, please. Father, what? Boy, excuse me, please. Father, okay. The boy on his way out says, tomorrow I'm not going to say it because I said it two times. Sounds real. There's family too. Mother and son are in kitchen. Boy, can I go out? Mother, yes. Oh, no, I guess you can't. I didn't realize how late it was. Boy, oh, please, mother. I never get to go down the street. Mother, well, I tell you, you can ride your bike on Fall Street. Boy, on Spring Street. Mother, well, just once. Boy, why just once? Mother, well, you don't really want to go out. Boy leaves. Baumrind could rate the first father high in control and high in maturity demands. She could rate the second mother low in control. You know, she shifted her demand. She didn't enforce it at all. And low in rational discussion. She's giving in to emotional pressure from the child here. Neither of these vignettes would be scorable on nurturance. But we have many observations of each parent, right? So what happens in just one vignette isn't the whole score for the parent-child relationship. So what do you think? Does this sound real, sound believable, what's being observed? I think it rather does. Now, Baumrind compared this parenting data with the three types of preschoolers she had identified earlier. Oh, I don't have a figure for this. Never mind. She found that the parents of the competent children were higher than the parents of the withdrawn and immature children in all four characteristics, which, if you think of it, runs contrary to what might have been believed in Berkeley in the late 1960s, high in control as well as high in nurturance and responsiveness to the child. In subsequent studies, Baumrind and others have been able to measure and describe more precisely really three styles or types of parents that can be commonly found in most populations and which are fairly stable over time. Later we added a fourth style, and these four styles can be most easily described by how they differ along two dimensions, demandingness and responsiveness. Demanding parents are those who set standards for their children and enforce them. They're not afraid to exert their power when necessary. Responsive parents explain the reasons behind their demands and discipline. They encourage verbal give and take, and they attempt to take into account their child's desires. Now, this figure shows how these two dimensions create four boxes, or really four styles of parenting. At one extreme, in the lower right corner, we have neglecting parents. They are neither demanding nor responsive to their children. Then we have the upper right and lower left quadrants, upper right authoritarian or domineering parents, you might say. And in the lower left, the indulgent or permissive parents. These are the labels that Baumrein used. You might disagree with them, but the observations would be hard to disagree with. These parents are either high in demandingness or responsiveness, but not both. And then in the upper left quadrant, we have the authoritative parents, the ones who have the most competent kids. They are high in both demandingness and responsiveness, so it's the combination that seems to be the trick. Baumrein's original research and hundreds of studies that have followed have consistently found that this authoritative style of parenting produces much better outcomes for children on average. As preschoolers, the children of authoritative parents are less socially disruptive, they're more cooperative with peers, they're less dependent upon adults, and they are active, assertive learners. There's research in the middle years of childhood, and then there's a lot of research in adolescence as well. But as teenagers, these children of authoritative parents get better grades, they're less susceptible to antisocial peer pressure, they get along with their parents better, and they have fewer problems with alcohol, drugs, and early sexuality. These research studies have been extended to groups of Americans that differ quite a bit from that original sample. For example, one of the earliest subsequent studies found almost identical findings to Baumrein's in a sample of low-income African-American families in Detroit. The findings have not always been the same, however. For example, the domineering or authoritarian style of parenting has about an equally positive effect on children as the authoritative style in studies of Asian-American and African-American adolescents. This surprised us. In these studies, demandingness is the key, regardless of how much nurturance and verbal give and take goes with it. We aren't sure exactly why this is so, but we suspect that a more domineering parental role is more legitimized by these cultures and therefore more accepted by those children. Now here's a tough question we ought to ask. Are we sure that authoritative parenting really causes better child development? Or could the opposite be true? After all, it's a lot easier to exert parental control over some children than others, right? Those kids could make us look good. The best way to answer this question would be with an experiment. We could train some parents to act in a more authoritative way, and then we could see, do their kids turn out better? In fact, we have studies that show exactly that. Some of the best are those, in my view, coming out of the Oregon Social Learning Center, where Dr. Chamberlain works, who you'll hear from in a few minutes. Since the 1960s, they've been conducting rigorous research on the life course of very difficult children, kids who make family life miserable for their parents and siblings, and who already have come to the attention of school and juvenile justice authorities even before adolescence. These researchers have also tested different ways of helping these families change the patterns of behavior and get these children back on a better life course track. These children, identified as problematic so early in life, are among the most likely to become criminals later in life, and they are among the most difficult to help. And yet, the Oregon Social Learning Center has been very successful at changing outcomes for those kids, and in fact, even for their siblings. Their parent management training program is based on the same foundation of ideas as authoritative parenting. Parents are taught how to effectively reassert control of their families and at the same time how to communicate nurturance to their children. With luck, Dr. Chamberlain may tell us something more about this in a few minutes in regard to their training program for foster care parents. This program of research shows that we know how to help parents change in the ways that really matter. And that, by the way, is exactly what I said a couple minutes ago about those intensive home visiting programs for infants. These are two types of programs that have been shown through rigorous experiments to be effective at helping parents learn to promote secure attachment with infants on the one hand, or to learn authoritative parenting skills on the other. And our briefing report, by the way, says a bit more about both those programs. But is it really the proper role of government to be intervening in how people raise their children? Well, let me suggest that rearing children has always been viewed as the private domain of families and not government's responsibility. But families don't exist in a vacuum. They live in communities. And some communities make it easy to raise children, and some communities make it very hard. Government policy has pervasive, inevitable effects on the communities in which we raise our children. State lawmakers can't choose to either have or not have an impact on family life. The impact is inevitable, whether large or small, in every bill that's passed. So while child-rearing is the direct responsibility of families, government has a strong role in creating the conditions in which families can do their best. Most families don't need specialized programs of the types I've been describing. Most families live in functioning, supportive communities. Most parents find ways to learn the skills of competent child-rearing through their own upbringing and their everyday social network interactions. I suspect Dr. Doherty is going to tell us a bit more about this sort of thing in a few minutes. But some parents don't learn enough in these naturally occurring ways, especially parents who are isolated from supportive communities. And these specialized programs are in particular for them. The implication of all this is that if we want to dramatically decrease juvenile delinquency and crime, increase a variety of positive outcomes, including school performance, then we have some pretty strong ideas on how to do it. But as you might expect, it might not be easy to do so. Not every home visiting program has shown positive impacts, and the Oregon Social Learning Center's program exercises very stringent quality control to ensure that their program continues to work. In other words, not every program of this type works. The quality of the program is crucial, in particular the quality of the staff. Let me summarize now with a modest number of fairly immodest claims. In this talk, I've claimed five things. First, that to a surprising extent, we can say what competent parenting is. No small claim there. And I've shown you how. We've defined competent parenting not by sitting back in our armchairs and dreaming up a theoretical scheme, but by going out and observing real families. They're the real experimenters. We just observe them. So we've defined it by studying which children turn out best in the ways that most American families want. We know that if parents change their child-rearing behaviors to become more competent, as we've defined competence, then their children actually turn out better. Their children will become more cooperative and less aggressive with peers, more compliant and less troublesome with parents and teachers. They'll do better in school and so forth. We know of some programs which, when targeted to the parents who most need our help, can consistently teach those parents how to raise their children substantially better. I briefly described two. There are also other effective approaches, although the two that I've described, for my money, are the two most powerful that we know of. We know that mounting successful programs like these is difficult, and not every parenting program will have these dramatic impacts. But we know it's possible today, with our current knowledge, to think that we might make a tangible, observable difference in the quality of child-rearing in this state, in particular in the quality of child-rearing by those who are currently most at risk for failing as parents. Thank you.